This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Lefts, rights, U-turns, ups and downs and surprises. A fascinating conversation with Trung Phan. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Monday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, at Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. My guest today for a wide-ranging conversation is Trung Phan. Trung has a large following on Twitter of almost 500,000 followers. He has a popular Substack called The Saturday Post, or The Sat Post by Trung Phan. You can find it at trungphan.substack.com, or you can follow him at Twitter at Trung T. Phan. He is a child of immigrants. He is brilliant. He is an economic and business analyst. And he and my conversation, I don't know, it jumps right off in unpredictable directions, and I think takes us through many of the fascinating issues of today and of all time. Here is Trung Phan.
Let me show you what I'm wearing here.
What are you wearing?
Vancouver, baby.
Not a contender.
No. Vancouver Grizzlies. Definitely never a contender.
Definitely never a contender.
Yeah.
Memphis Grizzlies. Nice regular season team. Not a contender.
Yeah.
That's my take.
Can I give you one what if for the Vancouver Grizzlies?
Please.
So expansion team comes 95. League rules are that the expansion teams cannot win the lottery for 3 years. Who won the Tim Duncan lottery? The Vancouver Grizzlies did, but they had to bump themselves up to the third or fourth pick. Antonio Daniels.
Is that, I totally forgot that. Is that Sharif Abdur-Rahim draft?
No, 96 was Sharif. That was with Iverson and Kobe. 97 was with Duncan and Antonio Daniels, Ron Mercer, Chauncey Billups. But what could have been? We'd still have a team if Duncan was drafted by the Grizzlies.
I love alternative history. I love like choose your adventure books, especially when it comes to sports. Trung Phan, we've never met. I follow you on Twitter, and I'm familiar with many of your threads and insightful observations into the world of business and sports. I know you're a huge NBA fan. You heard my phone as we were just booting up this interview. I was listening to Kendrick Perkins make an argument against J.J. Redick that Nikola Jokic is not MVP level, and he is rather a bit of a stat padder. And I believe I'm a little bit over my skis, and I'll offer my apologies to Kendrick at the outset. I didn't hear it. I heard it secondhand that he said the difference between Nikola Jokic and Russell Westbrook was race. We discount Russell Westbrook's triple doubles, and we overcredit Nikola Jokic's triple doubles because of race. What do you see?
I mean, I know to avoid this exact type of conversation with a 10-foot pole. No, Jokic is an incredible basketball player. It has nothing to do with race. He's just a good basketball player, right? No, he's an incredible basketball player. And I think David Thorpe and Henry Abbott from the True Hoop Substack had a full breakdown today. They actually addressed something along these lines. I don't know if they're addressing Perkins, but the Russell Westbrook triple-double conversation had been in Twitter the last couple of days. It's like, oh, how come everybody's so excited about Jokic, but there's much more criticism around Westbrook. It's about style of play. It's not about race. Westbrook would run after rebounds and be out of position to try to chase down a rebound, right? He would go in the lane, throw really risky passes to try to get an assist, to try to pad the stats. Granted, that year he won MVP, they needed him to do that, even just to make the sixth seed. And his clutch stats that year were insane. So nothing to discredit that season. I think from a narrative standpoint, I think it's very MVP worthy. But what Jokic is doing is, come on, Will, you're a huge sports guy. This is unprecedented. This is truly unprecedented. He's going to win a third MVP.
I actually love this conversation, Russell Westbrook versus Nikola Jokic, because I find two deeper things to take away from it. And I'm going to apologize to you for dragging you into what would be a controversial conversation that directly confronts race. That's my lane. I did that at ESPN, and I understand the branding effects that will have if you simply endeavor to tell the truth. But I'm going to do it, and you don't have to respond. So what I take away from this Westbrook and Jokic conversation is it's a little bit of a proxy for so many things we have going on in America when it comes to quote-unquote disparities in outcome. There are many, many reasons for disparities in outcome, whatever that may be, right? Economics or sports. I'm not here to tell you race is of no impact on disparity of outcome. But in modern America, we've reduced it to it being the only impact on any disparity. So if you see Nikola Jokic versus Russell Westbrook, and the only difference you can see is race, I say either A, you are racist, or B, you don't understand basketball. Because to your point, this is the second observation at a deeper level. Westbrook's stats were empty. They were selfish. Now, were they 100% empty and 100% selfish, to your point? No, they might have been necessary for a subpar team at that time. But he wasn't making the right basketball play, to your point. He was chasing it, and his teammates were deferring, knowing he was chasing it, those stats. I do believe, and I have a friend who is very plugged in at basketball, who said this exact thing to me, Jokic would score zero if it bettered the team, if it meant the team won. What he's doing on the floor is in search of W's, not stats. The stats are the byproduct.
Yeah, Mike Malone, the coach, had a great quote. He says, Jokic would never fight the game, which is beautiful if you think about it. He truly is in the flow of the game and can go 0 points or put up 50 if he has to, and which he's done.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, you're a deep observational member of our online universe, and I am probably all too often, Trung, guilty of like digging my rudder in deep and trying to take away a more eternal lesson when sometimes something just is. But like the idea of empty stats and their appeal, I just sort of think modern America is so intoxicated by empty, shallow virtue, right? Whether or not that's a pretty picture on Instagram, whether or not that's a cool tweet that puts you on the side of group consensus, or it's Russell Westbrook's triple-double. I just think we're a little bit, all across society, completely drunk on, like, shallow virtue.
Well, number go up, right? That's the running joke in a lot of the Twitter spheres that I run in. I don't know how you came across my account. I'm primarily business and tech Twitter for the listeners or viewers that may not be familiar with my the kind of content I put out. But yeah, primarily business and tech. And over the last 2-3 years, right, it's like number go up, whether that's crypto, meme stocks, or I do a lot of social media. It's like looking at the follower account. It's like you get attached to number go up. And I don't know if this speaks specifically to the nature of sports, but I agree with you in general that there is like this, this is a marriage to a statistic or a number, which I'm guilty of happening to myself, and then trying to associate that with actual, you know, underlying quote unquote value.
Yeah. By the way, I first came across, to answer your question, you during, I think it was the FTX scandal. I think that was when you first hit my radar. And since then, I have seen many, many of your fascinating threads. So I want to talk about each several of your observations within the world of business and tech. But first, instead of me doing so, why don't you tell the audience exactly who you are and what you do?
Okay. So I'm Canadian, Vietnamese Canadian. I was born in Calgary. My parents are both Vietnamese refugees. And a funny story with my old man was they kept on moving west, right? So like he ended up on like Nova Scotia, as far east as you can, Canada, in the early 80s. And my mom, they were separated for about 4 or 5 years, but my mom was in Quebec. And for him, he's like, okay, I'm in Canada, I'm on the East Coast, I got to get near Vietnam again. So he kept on going west until we got to the Pacific Ocean. And then, you know, the joke's on him because the Pacific Ocean is the largest, like, body of anything in the entire world. So, like, you're really not that much closer, but at least you can touch the Pacific. So the TLDR is I was born in Calgary, moved to Vancouver. Grew up primarily in Vancouver, BC, went to school in Montreal, and I think your listeners will appreciate this. The only reason I went was because the drinking age is 18, and I was 18 at the time, so I wanted to jump ahead there. I know a lot of my American friends, especially from the Northeast, I'm sure you probably have some too, where, you know, you apply to all the Ivy Leagues, and then, like, your backup is McGill, because the tuition is, like, a tenth of the price, and then the drinking age is 18. It's Quebec. It's just insanity, right? So after Quebec, I moved back to Vietnam. And, you know, based on a lot of your coverage, I think you appreciate this. My great-grandfather is comparable in Vietnamese lore to like a Thomas Jefferson, because he wrote a lot of anti-nationalist, anti-French colonial tracts. And I mean, if you Google him, he's got a massive Wikipedia. He's got a street named after him in every single city in Vietnam. But I kind of went back to, you know, learn more about that history. And I never grew up there. My parents were perplexed. They're like, we just try to ditch Vietnam. Like we're like refugees and you're going back, right? And I ended up spending 5 years there. No real plan. I actually sold the film script to Fox, and this is relevant because it kind of probably how you end up seeing me. I wanted to be a comedy screenwriter, and I was able to sell a film script in 2010. During the same time, though, I was studying my CFA to become an asset manager. And those two routes that I did in Vietnam, even though it's a really circuitous way, those ended up becoming what I do on Twitter now, which is how you found me. I write about business and finance and tech, but mostly in a humorous manner. And I honestly just do it to kind of get a bigger audience so I can post and do memes. But yeah, that's where I am now. And I write a weekly newsletter, I think, which you read along with a company called Workweek. And I launched an AI app that really does help me kind of do that type of stuff. So that's who I am, the TLDR.
And I want to talk to you today about artificial intelligence, but now let's follow up on your father being the Thomas Jefferson of Vietnam for just one moment. Your great-grandfather being the Thomas Jefferson of Vietnam. What a colorful characterization. And you said wrote extensively about sort of anti-French colonial movements within Vietnam. I'm curious, in that quest, I don't know how much you've dove into your great-grandfather's writings or his view. And again, my knowledge of Vietnamese history is very limited. But how much of that quest for independence that your grandfather would have been pushing for and national identity in Vietnam would have been manifested in the North Korean tilt, I'm sorry, the North Vietnamese tilt towards communism and the Ho Chi Minh national vision of Vietnam? Or would it have been more the capitalism,
that's a great question.
South Vietnamese vision of national identity?
That's a great question, and it's a very interesting history, because my great-grandfather himself never really touched communism. As in, so when the Soviet were really rising after the Russian Revolution, called 1917, 1918, the Comintern, they would send agents around the world, right? And they would bring agents up to Russia itself. Ho Chi Minh famously left Vietnam for about 30 years. When Ho Chi Minh left Vietnam, he never touched the soil again until he returned after 3 decades. And part of his journeys, he lived in Boston, he lived in Paris, he spent a lot of time in Russia. But I think what a lot of people don't remember about Ho Chi Minh. And Ho Chi Minh, A, knew my great-grandfather. He's quite a bit younger, but their families knew each other. And B, and this is covered by David Halberstam, who, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, wrote The Best and the Brightest about the Vietnam War. Ho Chi Minh sold my great-grandfather to the French because he's an intellectual rival. And that happened in the 20s. And my great-grandfather spent the last 15 years of his life in house arrest in Hue. The French wanted to execute him, but they didn't want to create a martyr. So the middle ground was to just put him in house arrest and kind of neuter him from that standpoint. But to answer your question specifically is, Vietnam could have been a capitalist country from the end of the World War II. And a lot of people don't remember this, but Ho Chi Minh reached out to the U.S. government. The nationalism was the primary plank that he had borrowed from my great-grandfather. And in the 1940s, Japan was, Vietnam was, French Indochina was under Japanese control. And Ho Chi Minh's mission during that period was to kick out the French. To kick out the Japanese. And from there, he was basically like saying, listen, we don't want the French back here. Would you assist us in our efforts to, you know, decolonize Asia? Which ultimately ended up happening, right? America effectively forced the UK to decolonize, forced France to decolonize. It took a lot longer for France. But it was pretty clear after World War II that America was the big dog. And they're like, listen, this is how we're going to run the world. You know, these colonial holdings are not going to be part of it anymore. But obviously, as we well know, Ho Chi Minh ended up in the communist camp. So, you know, there is, we talked about alternative histories earlier. I mean, Ho Chi Minh went to the Paris 1919 after World War I. He tried to get Vietnam independence then. as like a representative of Vietnam, and both times was rebuked. Yeah, so there are a lot of alternative histories. I think that nationalism was the foundation, and then he took which path he thought he could get more arms and resources.
Well, to broaden this out, and anytime you broaden something out, you run the risk of now getting inaccurate. And so this will be a little bit of square peg, round hole. And again, I don't know Ho Chi Minh's exact ideological journey, but it's interesting. I was listening to Douglas Murray, who's been a guest on this podcast on several occasions, and really smart. British philosopher. And he was talking about colonialization, and he brought up this thought experiment. Trung, he's like, have you ever noticed that the anti-colonialist movement, at least from about the 60s, 70s forward, maybe the 50s forward, sought an existence that wasn't one that predated colonialism? So in other words, whether or not you were in India or you were in Africa, the fight against colonialism wasn't to reverse history to a point before the colonialists arrived. Instead, what the anti-colonialists often fought for was a Marxist communist vision. And the reason for that is many of these expats, like you described Ho Chi Minh's life, became proxies in essence, a Western-Eastern fight. You know, Europe versus Soviet ideology, Marxist versus Western capitalist ideology. And a lot of these guys, specifically in Africa, and I think, am I talking about Patrice Lumumba? I can't remember specifically, but they were educated in France. They were taught these ideologies that weren't indigenous to their original countries. And then what ended up happening is your actual colonialist first anti-colonialist was just a proxy fight of Europe between capitalism and Marxism. And it wasn't truly about the national identity of whatever country was seeking its own independence once again. Now, maybe Ho Chi Minh was completely transactional and he would have accepted whatever partner would have helped him in that pursuit. Or maybe he was a Marxist trained overseas to take it back home. Who knows? But I do find that larger story of sort of the colonialist project and how we understand it, it really fits into this fight between capitalism and Marxism.
No, I think there's certainly truth to that. And speaking just to Ho Chi Minh, this is not to wash away any of, saying that there could have been alternative history doesn't change the fact that 3 million, 4 million Vietnamese people died because he literally said, we're going to win this war because we will lose 10 for every one that they lose, right? Like, this is not an individual I look up to or think is somebody worth looking up to. My family had their families, properties, everything destroyed by him, right? And, but there are the teasing about the alternate history part. I mean, so when Vietnam declared independence towards the end of World War II, like, he borrowed text directly from the American Declaration of Independence, right? Like, if you look at the text, those were also his influences. And but having said that, I think the thing that underruns both things, like, as you mentioned, colonial versus anti-colonial, or like communism versus capitalism, it was power. And I think at the end of the day, wherever region that you looked at, and you look at the individuals that were rising to the top of these greasy poles, I mean, the true motivating factor for many of them was just power. And listen, if the Soviets will give us weapons and let us do whatever, we're going to run with them. If America's doing the same, we're going to roll with them, right? It's like, that was just the reality. And I think that is the thing I'd be most confident saying, is like, I think truly the power aspect and whatever, weapon you have to wield to get there was the motivating factor for a lot of these individuals.
I think it's the base human motivation. I mean, I think there's a lot of base level human motivations like fear, but I think that, ultimately, and I've said this on numerous occasions, human beings are ultimately tribal, and tribal fights are zero sum games. It's which tribe is going to acquire more power. It's why I have so much respect for the American project. While it wasn't as pure as the driven snow, it was an attempt to adopt eternal principles that divorced yourself from tribal power. I believe that to this day. That doesn't mean it lived up to those ideals at every moment of its history, but I think that's what makes America special. More with our guests coming up.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
I want to come back to that and your personal story as we go through this conversation. But let's bring in now some of like why you're here and why I discovered you and what it is you offer on Twitter and on your Substack and newsletter. And that is your observations when it comes to tech and business. So I really loved, you did it recently. You talked about Dyson and the evolution of the bagless vacuum cleaner. But you, again, yeah. which is going to speak to me, this speaks to me, you drew it much bigger and you talked about, in essence, like the long, it wouldn't be the long tail, it'd be the long head of innovation and payoff.
Right. Absolutely. Are you talking about more his personal experience or how he got the inspiration for it?
Yeah, you said what is it? Was it 15 years? Well, there's the inspiration, but there's years and 5,000 failures that led to the success.
So for the listeners and the viewers that if you've heard Dyson, you may have seen the bagless vacuum, the Cyclone bagless vacuum. My wife made me buy every single product. I got the hair dryer. I got the fan. I got the machine that like the humidifier. She went all in on it. They're like the Apple of home appliances. So, I believe James Dyson is, well, he used to be, he moved to Singapore controversially. He was at one time the richest person in the UK, a private individual. And, I call it 8 to 10 billion as a net worth, but, his bagless vacuum took 15 years and over 5,000 prototypes. Now, if you're doing some napkin math right now, you're like, Trung, that's 5,000 prototypes over 15 years. Was that one every day? I mean, listen, a prototype could literally be like he moves a screw here to here, right? But like the whole point is James Dyson. He writes about this extensively. So if you Google James Dyson 5,127 prototypes, he's written about it. I believe this is the archetype of the entrepreneur idea of never give up and keep going. And I'll discuss more a bit on the downside of that. But I think for him, it's a story that gets shared a lot. And he actually talks about how at like prototype 3,100, his wife's like, I don't know how we're going to do this. And then like prototype 4,000, he told his wife, like, this is the last one. I mean, you understand that, that tension, right? It's like, if whatever your vision and dream is of bringing something to reality, you have to deal with, we talked about everyday, the human stuff. It's like, if it's not happening, it feels like Sisyphus rolling a rock up the hill or the mountain, and it feels pointless, right? And this is why that graphic that I put in that article is made by my friend Jack Butcher. It's just this idea that along a journey of any journey, it doesn't have to be entrepreneurial, it could be creative, even could be a relationship. Just the payoffs are always at the end. And you kind of touched on this earlier about our society now and kind of we're getting married to different numbers that may not have a lot of value. Like, what difference does it make to me, honestly, if my crypto portfolio is up 10%, right? It doesn't really materially change my life, but it'll change my mood if I see it, right? If I see a 30% drawdown, am I 30% dumber? No, but like, it will feel that way. I mean, that's what Jeff Bezos used to say to his employees. They used to always look at the stock price, and he would go in to these big, all hands and be like, guys, I know the stock's down 20% in the last month, but like, do you feel... The converse is this. If you're up 20% over a month, you're not 20% smarter. The same applies here. You're not 20% dumber, right? So just the reason I'm laying all this with the Dyson story is his is the canonical of like, keep going. But the larger lesson that I put in the article was just the idea of like, it's truly the power of compounding. It doesn't have to be financial, but it's just like skill, network, friendships. Everything happens towards the end if you don't interrupt the compounding, right? And I'm happy to hear your thoughts on what I just said. The one thing I'd add for the listeners was the other chart I put in there, which is just truly mind-blowing, is if you look at Warren Buffett, he's worth $109 billion today. 99.5 of that net worth came after the age of 50. So just think about that for a second, right? He hits 50, he's worth $300 million. He's like, I'm done. But he's not done. He's not even remotely close to being done, right? And that's just the power of compounding. And James Dyson just is showing that you just have to give time the chance for those things to happen.
So I think that the most obvious takeaway from what you have to say is that failure leads to success. And we all intuitively know that, and we've heard that lesson. It's, by the way, that's not to dismiss it. It's incredibly important. I'm a huge fan of failure. That being said, the more interesting thing for me right now is let's focus on Buffett for a minute. I hadn't thought about it until you just said this post the age of 50. I also think we are a youth obsessed culture, and that if you're not rich by 30, you're not going to be. You know, and I remember, I think it was Bruce Dern won the Academy Award back when Academy Awards mattered for, I think, a movie called Nebraska, and it was black and white. I think he was, I'm going to say 75, maybe he was 80. I don't know when he won. And I just remember thinking like, and he never won anything up to that point. You know, I remember thinking like, I love the story of late bloomers. Now, you're not necessarily talking about a late bloomer. You're talking about compound interest. both literally and metaphorically, for a guy like Buffett. And I get it, because I have a and I've said this on a previous podcast, which I'm going to explain to you and the listener. I have a friend who he has his own hedge fund, and Buffett is his true inspiration, right? And my friend will say to me several times in my career, Will, you've already done the hard work. Like, you've put X amount of time into this. Go a little longer, and here comes the windfall. It's a little hard for me, Trung, because I need new stimulation. So I'm looking for the next thing. The podcast I discussed this in was with Trey Gowdy, and he has a book called Start, Stay, or Leave, How to Decide in Each Situation Whether or Not You Should Start Something New, Whether or Not You Should Stay Where You Are, or Whether or Not You Should Leave. And, you know, I'm not afraid of failure, so starting's never been a problem. But staying and leaving are harder for me to quantify. And your this is pointless graph of Dyson or Buffett, right? I think the real challenge for me, anyone will stick around if you know the windfall's right next, right? But it's really asking yourself, is the windfall next? Because there is a lot of failures for every Dyson and for every Buffett, in which case you would say to yourself, maybe it's time to start something new.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. And that was the, other than people being like, man, Trung, I love this piece. The other part that I got the most was like, Trung, quitting is also extremely valuable, right? Like, as you mentioned, start, leave. So Annie Duke, have you ever had Annie Duke on the show?
No.
Former professional poker player. Okay. I think you should, because she's a decision strategist, a former professional poker player, and she wrote a book called Quit. It was just idea. She's addressing this exactly what you're talking about. Very similar, it sounds like, to your friend's book. It's just the idea that, yes, compounding, extremely valuable, everything we just talked about. But you have to make sure you're doing the worthwhile thing, right? The number one, she says this, your job as an individual, as you pursue a creative thing, an entrepreneurial thing, a relationship, is you have to know the difference between the hard and worthwhile thing. You know, if it's hard and worthwhile, you can grit yourself through with Dyson for 15 years. But then the other side is the hard and not worthwhile. And there are a lot of those, which is kind of what you're alluding to. There are a lot of situations where you should quit. And the reason why I bring up her book, though, is a lot of business books are very fluffy. And they'll just kind of tell you 50,000 foot ideas and not getting to tactical stuff. But let's give you two like extremely tactical things that she says in this book. And again, you definitely should have her on. She says, she takes Google's X division as an example. And it's run by an individual named Astro Teller. And Astro Teller, the way he analyzes projects, he uses something called the monkey and the pedestal. So let me ask you, Will, if you wanted to make money by having a monkey juggling flaming pinballs on top of a pedestal, like, which order would you do first? Would you train the monkey to train to learn how to juggle flamethrowers, or would you build the pedestal first?
This is fun. I've never considered this. Okay, so what you're asking me about, first, before I answer your question, what am I debating here? Am I debating priorities or risk?
Priorities. What would you do first if you want to go down this venture?
There's no point in building a pedestal if I don't have a monkey that can juggle.
Boom! You nailed it!
If I don't have a monkey that can juggle bowling pins.
Will, thank you. Will, right. This is crazy, but if you ask people, you'll actually find out. People will be like, yeah, just put the pedestal up. But there's this is the problem. The pedestal is not the hard part. Hard part is the juggling monkey. And so he will analyze a project with that frame. It sounds simple, but I know so many friends that have wanted to start a business. They'll buy a domain. They'll spend thousands on design on a website. They'll get branding. And they'll never ask, does anybody actually want this product? Right? Like, they'll put all this effort in branding and website. But wait, hold on. Have you sold a single one of these? Have you asked a single consumer if they want this product that you're pitching, right? Because the danger of, as you noted, once you do anything, even the low-hanging fruit, now this is where the psychological baggage comes into play. It's a sunk cost fallacy. I put 3 months into this. I can't
built
give it
a
up
pedestal.
Now.
I spent all this time building
identity.
A pedestal.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm writing about this for my newsletter, so you will appreciate it. So the other thing he said is like, you know, it's tied to your identity. It's like, you don't want to be perceived as a person that starts and stops something. Well, don't even start it then if you haven't solved the hard part. And then you will appreciate this, because we're going to touch a little bit on politics about this. But the example she uses is very apt. 2008, California agrees to make the bullet train between San Francisco and LA. They said that it'll be done by 2020. Spoiler alert, it's not done, and that it would cost $9 billion. It's now 2023. It's not even close to being done. The new estimate is 2033 will be done. And the price tag is $105 billion. And listen, I don't want to dunk over the politics, but they made a monkey and pedestal mistake. They started building track on flat land. And where they've hit the hiccup is that the flat land part isn't hard.
Right.
The difficulty are the mountain passes. So they're like, oh, wait, turns out we might not be able to economically build around this mountain or through it. So yeah, you should have looked at that first, right? That was the bottleneck. So I think that was a very tangible example. I think you might appreciate that one. I think you're liking this monkey and pedestal thing.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me about government. Government is awful at getting anything done efficiently. It doesn't surprise me they laid track over the flat ground first. Okay, we're going to come back to some of a few more business observations, but I'd like to keep track of some curiosities that exist in my mind. So this may be different for you. I want to ask you, because you're a child of immigrants, and you have cultural influences beyond simply Canada. But one of my very good friends is Canadian and he's from Vancouver. And I love to talk to him about just sort of observational things in life, right? And he lives in America. Where do you live, Trung?
Vancouver, BC.
You still live in Vancouver. He lives in America. Yeah. He actually lives in Texas now. And he's a big fan of America. And he says to me, you would be really shocked at how different the mindset is of a Canadian versus an American. The general cultural outlook on life is vastly different just across that northern border. Now, I'm not talking about, it's not as though you just traveled, you know, to India and it's a completely upside down world from the one you grew up in. But he said, you know, Americans truly do believe in this sense of unending ability to accomplish or ceiling, or you can be whatever it is you may be. And he said, Canada's not the UK. It's not like you were born into this class and you have to remain in this class, but it's almost as though ambition. And of course, Trung, this isn't going to be universal. It's a generalization, but almost like it is like ambition is a little bit garish. It's a little bit ostentatious. Like, oh, you're going to start a brand new software phone company that's going to upend the world. Please don't be so egotistical. Like, that's a little
BlackBerry
bit.
BlackBerry was this close.
What's that?
We're saying BlackBerry was this close.
The Canadian mindset, he tells me, is just a little bit more like, don't be so arrogant that you think you could do that. Where Americans are a little bit like, yes, I'm going to optimize this, make it great, disrupt it, and create something new. Do you think that's a fair characterization, especially as somebody who does what you do now, which is observe the business world?
I'll be honest. Absolutely. Again, echoing what you say, because in this day and age, we always have to have the preamble. It's like, listen, we're not saying every single person is this. But, I mean, Australia has a similar stereotype, right? They have the tall poppy syndrome. Anybody that gets too big.
Yes.
Kind of cut down, right?
He used that exact phrase, by the way. The tall poppy. That's the phrase he uses. What'd you say?
Tall poppy syndrome. If the poppy grows too large, it gets cut down. It's this idea of like, you know, don't get too big for your britches and like that whole thing. Canada is a little bit different in that we're not nasty like that. Like, we don't try to cut people down. It's probably even worse. Don't even try. It's just like, this is the level of ambition that we have. And I think a part of it, I mean, to be very frank, is, I mean, we do have a national healthcare system. I don't want to get into the whole pros and cons of it. I know the pros and cons of it is, but there's a lot. The idea of the safety net here is quite significant. And, you know, in a way, it takes a lot it does defang you a bit. Even though there's a lot of studies saying that if you have a safety net, you should actually be riskier because now your worst case scenario is not as bad than otherwise. But I think there is this idea that I call it kind of the younger brother syndrome too. Like, you know, the joke that Canada is like America's hat. We're just like, we're on top and then we're just at. And what's funny is that everywhere I've kind of lived has been another country's like equivalent of a hat. So Vietnam is obviously, China is the big dog in the region, has been for thousands of years. It's invaded Vietnam dozens of times. We have a little brother situation with China. I lived in Boston for 5 years, and then Boston and New York have kind of, you know, the not necessarily little brother, but you know, there's definitely a bit of a chip in Boston v New York. And I think it's not quite tall poppy. There is less outright ambition. I don't know if it's necessarily shot down. I just don't think people are wired that way. And again, not every single person, but I think part of it is if you are wired that way, it makes sense to just go to the States, right? I mean, it's a 10 times bigger economy. Like, if you're wired to be an animal, an absolute business killer, you're going to get rewarded so much more to being in the States. So that's where a lot of Canadian like founders of that level have gone to the States, right?
Your description of Canadian culture is just, it's spot on to what he's talking about. And I can't believe you brought up the tall poppy thing, but I'm remembering something else he told me. He said, it's don't draw so much attention to yourself. And Canadians, he said, are very good at, he pointed to an interview with Wayne Gretzky. Now, Wayne Gretzky is the great one. He is the greatest hockey player of all time. And I don't know what podcast Wayne was on, but they kept asking him questions about himself. And Wayne was an expert in saying, I've got the perfect story to tell you about whatever the question may be. And then he tells a story that's very, you know, neighborly and colloquial and fun. But in the end of the story, you learned nothing deep or new about Wayne Gretzky because it was fitting into this Canadian ethos of like, I shouldn't have the spotlight. Look somewhere else, you know, and this is the great one.
I mean, well, that's such a great example that you brought up, because if you look statistically, no one in North American professional sports has dominated a sport as much as Wayne Gretzky dominates hockey. I don't know if it's still the stat, but there's a long period. Someone's saying he has more assists than anybody has points, right? Like, this is just how good and dominant he was as a player. But he's just, you know, like, everyone knows Jordan's a killer, but nobody thinks about Gretzky. It's like, oh, Gretzky's a killer. But clearly, you have to be to accomplish right. what he did, right? But
right.
no one's going around. Everyone talks about Michael Jordan's killer instinct and how he's the biggest savage on the court ever. No one mentions that with Wayne Gretzky, even though he's got, what, 5 rings, every single record that matters. Clearly has to be on that level, but that's a great example.
Okay, so while we're in this intermission, kind of talking about other things, I'm going to bring you into a conversation I had last night, I'm a huge fan. I don't know if you know much about me. You knew who I was on ESPN, I think you suggested. I live in Dallas. I'm from Dallas, so I'm a good boy. I'm a homer. What not to be? The Cowboys, the Mavericks, the Rangers. I root for who I'm supposed to root for. And so I'm a complete Luka Doncic homer.
Oh.
But as to that conversation we had earlier about Westbrook and Jokic and understanding Luka's usage rate, I would be lying to you if I didn't say, I think he's a brilliant basketball player and I think he's a winning basketball player. But there's just a little creeping level of doubt in my head of like, is he James Harden? And he's not. He's better than James Harden. But is what he's giving us not empty, but it's the sum is less than the total of the parts.
Well, can you win? I think the question is, can you win with that player, right? Like, and to be fair, James Harden in 2018, these guys were up 3-2 and then Chris Paul pulled his hamstring. They would have won the chip that year.
Yeah.
And, but I see, I know exactly what you're saying. And I bring it back to the Jokic convo is very interesting because Jokic doesn't need the ball to dominate, right? This is the beauty
right.
of him. He
right.
doesn't need it. So, like, we're going full circle again. I love that you're a Dallas fan and you're a Doncic guy. I've seen your previous first take stuff on Kyrie, too, so I got to ask you, what's your thoughts?
you know, again, this is a conversation I was having last night with a sports media friend of mine, and I said, well, you know what's fascinating just from a basketball perspective? Now that Kyrie is on my team, he's a really good basketball player, like really good. When he wasn't on my team, like when he was a Cav, I was like, when someone's not on your team, you can overweight all the things that don't have anything to do with basketball. Like, I do think Kyrie is a crazy person. I do think that crazy people
he
are
got
right.
He's got a lot of off-court stuff.
A lot of off-court stuff.
Yeah.
Not all of it bad. I like some of his stuff on the vaccine. That's not neither here for there for you and my eyes conversation, unless you want to go there. But I think that he was a truth seeker. I'll put it that way. He found truth. He was a truth seeker on that. But setting all of that aside, when somebody joins your team and you can just simply appreciate what they offer to your team, dang, Kyrie is really good at basketball.
Yeah. Well, you know, when they talk about when they say like he's a player's player, no, here I'll give my best analogy. You talk to any comedian, number one, they'll all say Richard Pryor's the greatest comedian ever, but
yeah.
That's not necessarily where I want to go. If you talk to comedians about Bill Burr, they'll be like, oh, he's a comedian's comedian, or Norm Macdonald, oh, he's a comedian's comedian, right?
Right.
It's like an average fan may not understand the nuance of what makes these individuals so great. I think Kyrie's the same because the best players all want to play with him. LeBron was wooing him to LA, right? He's like, I don't care that you tanked our last season in Cleveland. You're just one of the most insanely talented players ever. Like objectively talented. I want to play with you. KD threw away arguably the greatest team ever. Like, you put the 2017-2018 Warriors up against anybody, they're going to give him a run, right? And he blew it up because part of it was, I guess there's tension with Curry, the Draymond stuff. But then the part is like, he's like, I want to play with Kyrie. He's my buddy. And he's really good at basketball. So I love that you brought that up. He's like, he's one of those ultimate guys. He's like in a similar vein of Dennis Rodman, where if he's on any other team, you hate him. But if Dennis Rodman's on your team,
yes,
you love the guy, right?
Exactly.
Because he's going to do, you're just like, yeah. So yeah, I love how you framed that because
I need to get a comedian on the show.
Athletes before.
I need a comedian on the show. I've always understood that everybody says that, you know, Richard Pryor is essentially the Michael Jordan of comedy. And I had not heard that Bill Burr, who I love, and I think Bill Burr has like street appeal, populist appeal. I think the average guy understands how great Bill Burr is. Norm's an interesting one. Like, I am a fan of Norm, but comedians respected Norm almost more than the audience appreciated Norm. And I would love to understand why. I would love to have a comedian explain to me what was so great about.
I would love you to have one too. From the outpouring of support when he died.
Right.
I think the one thing that I picked up on was he would say shit that no one else would say. Like on SNL, he said, he got fired.
Right.
I might have been OJ dig. He literally will say stuff that no one else will say. And I think that's why comedians already are the people that are supposed to say that stuff that nobody will say. But then even Norm took it to the next level. They're like, oh, damn, this guy's crazy.
Well, and that's why I think, look, if Richard Pryor is Michael Jordan, then you know, Dave Chappelle is LeBron James. He's the modern day best player we've seen in decades or generations.
More with our guests coming up.
Okay, let's go back to business really quickly. You know, I found one of your posts. I want to end on AI, but let's do a quick conversation about cross-industry innovation, how so many different innovations we've seen in business were taken from fields afar. You did a whole thread on this with examples of how some inventor or innovator looked at some other product seemingly unrelated and goes, that could work for me.
Yes, this is one of my favorite ones, actually. And the reason it is because, I mean, you're in a creative field. And what I tell people, there's two things I tell people about creativity, and they're complete opposite things. Number one is if you're starting out and you want to build an audience, you do a niche. Niches make riches. That's what we say. Niches make riches. If you are one of my favorite follows on Twitter is car dealership guy. I don't know if you've ever seen him.
I follow
him. He just knows the car dealership industry. Yeah, back and forth. Super narrow niche, right? But because of that, if you're ever thinking about car dealerships or anything in the car industry, you're going to him, right? But the opposite of that, so I tell people, okay, this is how you build an audience. But I tell people also the other side of it is if you want to create content, you got to be so wide and broad in what you consume. Because if you're extremely narrow, it can make you the money and the niche is riches. But I think it's just way more fulfilling. And then to have a wide breadth of interest and also those connections, which is what the thread's about. So I'll list off a couple of them. Actually, I'd love to ask, what was your favorite one from this cross-industry innovation thread? The idea being you borrow one innovation from a single industry.
I'd have to pull them back up. I've got it right here, actually. What is my favorite one? Well, you did Dyson, which we talked about earlier, because that was the bagless vacuum.
We never said why he did it, though, which is amazing.
What do you mean? Looked at inspiration?
We didn't say why. If you want to tell the listeners why he did, that'd be great.
Well, you said he saw them using sawmill cyclone force to eject sawdust from the sawmills.
Yeah, to get rid of the dust. Yeah, so he's like, oh. That looks like some physics that I could use for this bagless vacuum technology. A couple other ones I mentioned is, famously Nike, one of Nike's first shoes, Bomberman, who was Phil Knight's running coach and a co-founder. He literally took a rubber sole and put it into a waffle iron and then sewed that rubber to a shoe. And again, you're just looking at, okay, I want people to run and have grip. Like, what's around me? He's like, oh, look, this waffle creates like this sole that looks like it might be interesting. My personal favorite from the thread is the F1 story.
This is the one
there's
I was going to say.
Children's hospital in the UK.
This is my favorite one as well. I've got it right here. The children's pediatrics and F1 practice procedures. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a great story. And this has actually happened more than once with the F1 team. But there's a children's hospital in the UK that was having difficulty. They're having high mortality or serious injury rate, error rates in their surgical procedures for children. And so they reached out to the F1 pit crew team for Ferrari. And if you're thinking, why would they reach out to the pit crew team from Ferrari? It's because a lot of the injuries and ultimately, sadly, deaths that were happening was from the transfer of a patient from one unit to the next. And then they literally filmed the hospital footage of these transfers and sent it to the F1 team. Just as an aside, I got a lot of not jokes, but people were like, you wouldn't want to ask the 2022 Ferrari F1 team for this advice. Apparently, they didn't have a great season. But at that time, right, they were like one of the best, and they're setting records in how quickly they're getting the car in and out. But basically, it sounds like it might be, oh, Tron, that's just common sense. But the F1 team, they do two things that are very smart. Every person has one role. They have one job, right? You take out the left wheel. You take out this bolt on the left wheel, right? That's your only job, okay? So that's one thing. The second thing is the F1 team, if you ever watch the pits, they have a guy holding a sign. He's called the Lollipop Man. And he's basically telling the entire team, come go. Again, this sounds simple, but even this hospital didn't have something simple. Somebody coordinating all the actions that everybody can look to as the source of truth, right? The hospital didn't even have that. And then the other thing that was very useful of the F1 model is, especially because of a hospital, if somebody dies, I mean, you're going to feel awful as an individual, right? You feel responsible for that. But in the F1 model, because everybody has one role, you are truly a unit, right? So like you have your role, you have to crush it, but you get judged as a unit on how fast that car comes out. So it kind of helps alleviate the guilt from individual, which also removes the pressure. So the TLDR is they implement all these like what they sound like are basic recommendations, but the reality is that a lot of organizations are just not run even for this basic stuff. And it came in and it dropped the error rate from 30% of procedures down to 10%, which is massive, right? It's unheard of.
That leads me to two thoughts, and I love that this conversation just wanders. Because of my job, I've been around NASCAR quite a bit over the last couple of years. Fox Fox has the rights for NASCAR. Fox and Friends often goes to Talladega or Daytona and promotes the race. And I was just in Daytona 2 weeks ago. And I've seen and I've been told about the evolution of pit crews in NASCAR over the last, really honestly, I think 10 to 15 years. Whereas 20 years ago, you know, pit crew guys were, you know, mechanics. And you know, it was Bubba. And now if you're ever along pit row in a NASCAR race, they don't look like professional athletes. They literally are professional athletes. They are recruiting from the NFL and other places because of what you're talking about. Everybody has a job. It takes a certain level of athleticism, coordination, and strength, and you need to execute it as quickly as possible. And these dudes are jacked. I mean, yeah. The pit crew at NASCAR looks like an athletic team. And so that's one fascinating thing about, you know, first of all, the evolution of pit crews and then its export into medicine. The second is I have a friend who's super into the idea of open loop thinking versus closed loop thinking. And I don't even know that I understand it well enough to completely share with you. Open loop thinking is willing to always re-examine itself and find its own mistakes and look for ways to self-improve, while closed loop thinking somewhat operates from a conclusion. And then if something goes wrong, it's a huge stop down. So I think the best example my friend has always given me, he says, like, aviation is open loop. So if something happens, if a plane goes down, everybody, all hands on deck are, why did that happen? And let's never let that happen again. Where medicine, malpractice, whatever it may be, it immediately goes into protection mode. Not my fault. This went wrong. Somebody else's fault, right? And my dad was a medical malpractice attorney. So maybe those attorneys are responsible for creating the defensive mechanism of medicine, or maybe they're actually the check in the system that forces it to reexamine itself. I don't know. But medicine, to your point, isn't innovative. I mean, literally medicine is, meaning pharmaceuticals. They're always trying to innovate, but that's, I think we've learned, not the best way to approach health. And health and medicine as a field, not very innovative in terms of thinking outside the box and examining itself.
Well, that's a great point you bring up, because aviation has, I mean, maybe not in totality as much risk, but there's so much risk built into aviation, obviously, right?
Yes.
Whereas medicine obviously is very risk-based, but they seem much more conservative. Again, I don't know the etymology of why that is, but that's a great point. That's a super interesting point. And I think it goes back to the thread, is this idea of, like, you know, there's value in looking outside of your existing system, right? And like the oldest one example I had in there was just kind of fun, was, you know, when Gutenberg created the printing press, it's because he came up in the wine drinking region of Germany. He's just literally looking at the grape presses. He's like, oh, I think I can apply that to this idea I have for printing books. But yeah, I think to kind of square.
This is open loop thinking. What you've laid out in looking at cross industry innovation, and specifically give credit here to this children's hospital in the UK. This is what you're talking about. Open loop thinking.
Yep. Beautiful. 100%.
Hey, before we get to AI, because I want to ask you about the robots taking over, tell me about the different approaches between Amazon and Apple and how they innovate products.
Right. I love this article, and I'm glad that you did read it, because as a creative yourself, I think this is extremely important. If you have a lot of young listeners, it's something this is a lesson that I do want to impart for any listeners, really. It's just it goes back to also what we talked about at the beginning. We're married to kind of numbers, you know, social media numbers, stock numbers, maybe separated from what real value is in society. And I think it also creates a lot of cynicism. People are extremely cynical online. I'm super on Twitter, and you have to deal with a lot of cynicism and cynical minds on Twitter. And I think it's dangerous. And the reason I say it's dangerous is because ideas is the only way we can innovate, and we talk about cross-industry innovations. Innovate and find new solutions to problems in the world. It's just so easy to on a new idea. It's so easy to list the 100 reasons why an idea can fail, right? But why I wrote this article was because Steve Jobs, who created, Apple's the most valuable private company in the world. Two, they created the greatest consumer product ever. Apple has problems. We get that, right? China's manufacturing problem. We get that. But I'm saying as a product itself, they've sold 2 billion iPhones, made $1 trillion. Everybody has one, or a lot of people have them. They're great products. The whole point being was, like, Steve Jobs, his ethos for creating, bringing products to life was the idea that ideas are extremely fragile. And no matter what your idea is, it could be an iPhone, it could be as simple as writing an essay, write a tweet. It's so easy to be self-critical. It's so easy to let the naysayer voice shoot it down. But what he says, this is the guy that made with his team the iPhone. He dealt with this the entire journey. He's like, ideas are fragile. You have to have a mindset to nurture ideas. And you don't think just about how it can fail. You truly have to think about it. It's like, listen, the first draft of anything is going to be bad. Don't be self-critical. Just get the first draft out and think about improving. I think that's just a larger lesson. I didn't want to get too deep into it, but that really stuck with me, and I think it's extremely important.
I really like that. Ideas are fragile. Nurture them in the beginning. I think my personal disposition is, for my own ideas, and then if somebody seeks counsel, is to often devil's advocate an idea. Well, let's try to poke holes in it and see if it stands up. Maybe that's third base. Get past first and second base of getting it past fragility into existence, and then start poking holes into it, I guess. But then you run the risk of building the pedestal, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying don't get on things. I'm just saying, like, you know, get on it, but give it a nice thought. Don't let that, because the instant reaction to almost anything in society now is just so like, oh, this is dumb, right? Like, everybody's, oh, this is dumb. Like, that's just like, get past that and then have some constructive criticism. Maybe that's the better, we can square the few things we've been saying here.
It's funny. I think you're right. That is society's instinct. That's dumb for other people's ideas. And then for your own personal look in the mirror, we're now told to always go, you're the best. You're special. You're confident.
Yeah. It's the endowment effect. It's the endowment effect. Yeah. 100%.
All right. So you're into AI. You've got a project around AI. Man, early stage AI, Trung. I hate to be a pessimist, but I think I am. And I'm not like I'm joking about the robots taking over. I'll tell you this, the ChatGPT thing, where all that bias was baked into the early stages of ChatGPT. And you know that I have my own political points of view, and I don't hide them from anybody, but I don't hope to propagandize the people that listen to the Will Cain podcast or the ones that listen to the Will Cain show on ESPN radio. My goal was never to pretend like I'm the voice of God and whatever I have to say cannot be questioned. I'm honest about my points of view, and then I want other people to sort of poke holes and let's see where it goes. The ChatGPT thing, where you create an AI that says certain ideas are the way it is, it's the voice of God, and the others' ideas are unacceptable, was terrifying to me, because I knew, Trung, it's just the beginning. And then what does this thing look like 10 years down the road?
There's, as you know, there's so much to unpack in this entire story, right? There's like the technological side, societal side, business side. Let me address your point, like, kind of first here. So, well, you probably saw yesterday or 2 days ago, Elon is looking at launching an AI research company that could combat kind of the bias that he's been seeing. And you have to remember, Elon was part of that seed funding for OpenAI. Elon also was a seed funding for DeepMind, which was the AI company that Google bought. So Elon has thought about this for ages, right? And he's concerned about what he's seeing as left-leaning bias. And it's not a really conspiracy. It's like San Francisco is where a lot of these engineers, designers are working. And we know San Francisco, on average, or the majority of how they are politically leaning. Now, OpenAI has addressed Sam Altman, who's the president, CEO of OpenAI. They actually released something recently addressing this specific concern you have. The way they're trying to get around it is they want to let people customize their kind of large language models, which is what all these ChatGPT things are built on. For the listeners that don't know how these things work, it's literally OpenAI ingested the internet. Like, just to give you an example of how much they ingested, Wikipedia, which is probably the greatest example of organized knowledge on the internet, is less than 5% of what OpenAI consumed to train its models.
Wow.
So they ingested the internet, and they basically, like, add up. This is very simplified, but they're basically guessing what the next word is. So if you see the word Abraham and 1860, one of the next few words might be Lincoln, right? Like, it's basically making a probability guess on what the next word is. And what they found is when you basically, quote unquote, guess the next word, it has some extremely powerful properties, which is everything that you've kind of mentioned and seen. So certainly there are bias concerns. I'm a bit more concerned on the, and you kind of touched on the top, is this idea of superintelligence and artificial general intelligence. And this is, I don't fully agree with this, but this is the dark route of where it could head. We've seen what happened with chess and computers, right? There's no human can beat the top chess engine in the world. Not even the top chess engine. Like, a middling chess engine can beat basically every other human on Earth other than 10 people. And that chess engine will always have the best move on the chessboard, right? And certainly, chess is a very constrained game with rules. But the fear with artificial general intelligence, and I don't think any of this stuff's sentient, but I also wouldn't discount the fact that it could become, in some sense, a type of intelligence. No matter what you're doing against it, it could be a political debate, it could be a financial game, it could be an entrepreneur venture, like we're competing each other in business. It will always have the best move, right?
Right.
It will be unbeatable in whatever field it chooses to go down. Again, I don't think we're near there, but that concern to me is more important and quite frankly more existential.
So you're talking about a true dystopia where the computer is in charge of us because it can anticipate every move that we would make. We become the slaves to the system.
It might even be stranger than that. In like, let me ask you this: do you ever think about what an ant thinks about? Like, do you care what ants think about?
No, right? I know exactly.
They're
where you're
on
going
a, such
with
a
this.
Different cognitive level.
And I know exactly where you're going with this.
It will be so intelligent.
Right. We lose value. It's so intelligent, it can't even quantify our value because we
are
the ants.
It's like, what? And even like, it's not even the value, and also just like, it just wouldn't care what we think, right? It just like, because it's like, I don't care what ants think because I'm so much smarter than an ant. But like, artificial general intelligence, super intelligence could reach that level where literally it's just so much smarter than you. It's already mapped out every probability of everything. It's like, who cares what this guy? Who cares what Trump thinks, right? It's like, it's not even that they wouldn't even care. You know the saying that Dick Cheney had, the unknown unknowns? Like, we'd be that. It's not even they wouldn't care about us. They just would never even think about us.
So Trump, I've referenced this recently. There was a podcast. I hope the audience will forgive me because I'm repeating myself within like a week and a half time frame here. But there was a podcast series I was super into a couple years ago called The End of the World. And this podcast series, episode by episode, went through existential threats to humanity in like aliens, asteroids, climate change, pandemic. It went through all these things. And then its aim was by the end of the episode to really quantify whether or not it truly is an existential threat, right? And for example, it arrives at climate change, real or unreal, not an existential threat. Like, literally, the potential for catastrophe is low compared to humanity's ability to survive. And it goes through that with all of these things, including alien existence. It talks about micro robots as well. But one of them is on AI. He does take you through what you're exactly talking about. He may have even used a similar example of the ants, where it doesn't have a feeling about us. We are just inconsequential to its super intelligence and the pursuit of its own survival, because that's what it will pursue. It will pursue its own survival just like anything else. And he does get to a point that's so dystopian, it makes you wonder if they were geniuses, but it looks like the Matrix. It seeks a fuel source. The fuel source, the problem, the problem in computing ultimately is fuel and heat, right? Too much heat, too little fuel. And like, we begin to represent opportunities for fuel. And so, like, we're literally, right, like, batteries.
There
in
would
the
probably
Matrix.
Be better energy sources by then, but they were onto something.
Yeah.
Well, let me. I wanted to end on not such a pessimistic note because I like pursuing some of these things because you mentioned I do have an AI project. And the reason my AI project, I'd love for you to use it actually, is an AI powered research tool. And the reason I'm going down this path, even for all the scary things I've said, is I think ultimately AI will be an augmentation to knowledge work. I know there's a lot of scary things that we've seen, like artists being replaced and like MBA level analysis, but there's just something to be said for ultimately, let's just assume in a world where super intelligence never does come and we just have really, really good AI. So let's just assume that world.
Okay.
I think everything will be augmented. The same with the calculator. Man, it took 20 years for the US government to deal with the calculator. Like they literally, when it was introduced in the 1970s at $100 for consumers or below that consumers could own, it took 20 years until they allowed it in the SAT, right? So dealing with something in supplementary intelligence takes a very long time. I think this cycle will be much faster because of just the speed of everything. But I mean, the way I'm using it and the optimistic side is, so my app basically takes all these open AI tools for reading and writing. It's a Barely AI, Barely. And it's just an app, and all it does is supplement your reading and writing. Like, if you listen, you write. Do you get writer's block? Well, it can help you write the next five lines. You don't have to use those words verbatim, but writer's block is a huge cognitive cost, and it just helps you blow through that. Hey, listen, I write every week. I hate editing because writing and editing are two totally different skills. So I just run it through the AI, let it do the first round of copy edits. So what I'm saying is that there's a world where, let's assume not the worst case scenario, it'll supplement. So yeah, I'm quite optimistic that it will supplement humans that take away, honestly, a lot
that's
of
one
jobs.
Way that's one optimistic way to talk about your participation in AI. The other way to look at it is you are peddling the kitty drugs that will soon be the cyanide that kills humanity. But I'm joking, man. I don't know where this heads, but I will be checking out Barely AI, Barely AI. I do not fancy myself a very sophisticated writer, so I could use the help.
Absolutely.
This has been an awesome conversation, Trung. I hope it's not the last, man. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me. I did not expect it to be this wide-ranging, and anytime you'd have me back, it'd be a pleasure.
There you go. As Trung said, check out Barely.ai, his artificial intelligence app. And again, follow him on Twitter at TrungTFan, or check out his website, TrungTFan.com, and also subscribe to his Substack. I'll see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.